Thank you, David, and thank you to the organizers for inviting me to this meeting. I've really enjoyed the morning sessions a lot. So I want to tell you about some experiments that we've been doing measuring mobility in polymer glasses as these materials are being actively deformed in a highly nonlinear manner. I need to introduce the cast of characters here a bit. Haonan Li is a graduate student. Actually, he finished about a year ago, and he did almost all the experiments I'm going to tell you about. Ben Bending is a new student, and this work was done as part of a collaborative effort, that involved Juan de Pablo and Rob Riggleman, who did some simulations. I think Rob is back there in the back. I'll be talking a bit about those simulations. Jim Carruthers at Purdue did some mechanical measurements and also some modeling that I may have a chance to talk about. And Ken Schweitzer and Kang Chen did some theoretical development related to the measurements that we've done. Okay, so I think my talk's a bit of a change of pace compared to what we heard this morning, so I'm going to take a few minutes just to sort of set up what the problem is from my point of view. The question that interests me is what allows a polymer glass to flow. And I'll start with the practical side of things here and show you some real materials. These are all photographs of polycarbonate. So polycarbonate has a glass transition temperature of about 140 degrees C. So at room temperature, we are more than 100 degrees into the glassy state. But you can take a sheet of polycarbonate and you can bend it at a right angle without it breaking. You can take a rod of polycarbonate and twist it around something and deform it so that now that it has this shape. And best of all, you can take a cylinder of polycarbonate and you can put it into a press at room temperature, and in about 2 tons and 5 seconds, you have something that is shaped like this. One of the features of polycarbonate as a material is that it's tough. It can absorb a lot of energy without breaking. This is bulletproof glass made of polycarbonate, and this is another example of how a lot of energy can be absorbed without catastrophic failure. So from a more quantitative point of view, you may be interested, or I may remind you, what the stress-strain curve looks like for this type of material. You probably can't read everything here, but this is a constant strain rate experiment. So this is stress on this axis, strain here. The very top curve corresponds to room temperature, and it shows the essential features. There's an elastic regime way down here. The material yields at a deformation of about 4 or 5%. And then there's this very long plastic flow regime. And this particular sample at room temperature its dimensions could be deformed almost a factor of 2 before it broke. Okay, and of course the energy involved in deformation is the integral underneath this curve, and so the fact that this material can flow to the extent that it can in the plastic in the glassy state is a very important part of its if its functionality. So from my point of view, people have been thinking about this question for a long time. I should say I only started thinking about it about 4 or 5 years ago, and I'm sort of embarrassed to say that I hadn't really thought about it before. But when you think about it, this is really remarkable because if I hadn't told you how I got from here to here, you might have believed that I heated it up above TG and waited for a while, and the material just sort of sagged, and it flowed into that configuration. So it looks like the material flowed, but flow requires mobility. Liquids can flow. Glasses are formed at the point where they lack mobility. So how do we take a material which lacks mobility and make it flow like a liquid? And I think that's what got me interested in this problem. So some really smart people have already thought about this. 1936, Henry Eyring published a paper about plasticity, among other things. And he basically takes the viewpoint that deforming a glass induces mobility, transforms the glass into a very viscous liquid, and that liquid can then flow and dissipate a lot of energy as it flows. And in sort of a cartoon-like fashion, we could illustrate the eyring idea. Here's some sort of a solid with the system stuck in an energy minimum. Let's imagine that these barriers are high enough that the system at this temperature basically can never escape. So that's a glass. If we impose a stress on the sample, we can think about that as arising from this potential. If we add together the potential due to the stress with the original potential, we have a modified potential, and some of the barriers in that modified potential are lower, and the transitions can occur more rapidly. And so I think this is a fair representation of Eyring's idea. And Han Meyer, who's worked on this problem in Eindhoven for at least a couple of decades, he likes to describe it like this, and I think this is sort of an intriguing way to think about it, is that yielding is mechanically passing TG by applying stress to sort of complement the way I normally think about passing TG by adding thermal energy and turning a glass into a liquid. So there's polymer glasses are a reasonably big business, and there's been a lot of interest in trying to accurately model the deformation properties of polymer glasses. And so let me just, to give you just sort of a flavor of where this field is tell you about some of these efforts. So some people take the point of view that deformation increases mobility and that stress is the key variable. That if you know the stress, you know the mobility, and you can understand how the material will flow. And so this is a list of folks who I think it's fair to put in that category. But stress, so Eyring would also be in this category. But stress is not the only possibility. One could take the point of view that free volume is the important variable, and that deformation, particularly tensile deformation, increases the free volume of the system, allows it to flow faster, and so forth. If you like the Adam Gibbs model, you might identify the configurational entropy as the key variable, and somehow deformation changes the configurational entropy of the system, and then you would calculate the mobility perhaps using the Adam Gibbs equation. And Jim Carruthers, our collaborator, has worked on this idea, and his most recent model uses the configurational internal energy instead. So what all of these explanations have in common is that they use the idea of mobility being created by deformation. Yes?
So is it quite common for polymer glass to be so deformable? Or is it?
So polycarbonate is the champion, and so that's why I focused on it. But let's say if you work close enough to TG, essentially every polymer glass will exhibit a regime of this kind of ductility. Okay. Even systems like PMMA that we might normally think about as being a brittle polymer, if you, as I'll show you in our experiments, if you work within 20 degrees of TG, it exhibits all of the phenomena that I've shown you for polycarbonate. Okay, so these explanations have in common that mobility is the key. There are other explanations that don't invoke mobility. Early work by Mary Boyce and Ali Argon really took more of a solid state approach and talked about the deformation creating defects in the material, and then the defects propagate in certain ways. And so, you know, this is not the only way to think about the problem. And coming to this meeting, one of the things I thought about is there's almost no discussion in the polymer glass community of shear transformation zones. When I read papers about metallic glasses, I read about that all the time. So one of the things I'm interested in is why are there two different types of terminology used in these two different fields, and are they really the same thing, or are the problems fundamentally different? So I'll leave that as a question for now. So back to polymer glasses, mobility plays a central role in current efforts to describe polymer glass deformation. There were some previous experiments, really microscopic experiments that looked at how molecules move around, that are qualitatively supporting this idea. There were NMR experiments that were done during deformation. There were diffusion experiments in which diffusion was much enhanced by deformation. But I think it's fair to say the measurements that I'm going to show you are the first that really let us quantify microscopic changes in microscopic mobility during active deformation of a polymer glass. And so I want to describe that for you. And I guess one of the, I think there is a real world problem behind all this modeling, and maybe I'll just briefly mention that. I think that if we can better understand what's fundamentally happening in these materials, we really can build better models to predict long-term performance. And so one particular example that might be relevant is the Boeing 787 aircraft. 50% by weight of that aircraft is going to be a polymer composite, including the wings and the fuselage. And you think, start thinking about the challenges of developing a material that will last for 40 years and can respond favorably to stress cycles and temperature cycles and relative humidity cycles, and you realize that you can't possibly, you don't have 40 years to test this material, right? So you're really relying upon having good engineering models in order to know whether this material is going to be successful or not. And so I think better modeling is a good idea. Okay, so the way that we do our experiments is we take a polymer glass and we disperse a small amount of a dye molecule in the glass. So something like one part per million by weight. And then we measure the reorientation of these dye molecules, and we use that to learn about how the polymer is moving. So this, for example, is one of the molecules that we've used. And PMMA is one of the systems that we've used. And sort of a key assumption for us is that the rotation of this probe is really a good reporter of what the polymer is doing. And I think we have some really solid arguments that this is the case, and let me just present one of them. Here, if you look over on this side, you'll see the dynamics of the melt state of PMMA, and the circles here represent the reorientation times of these dyes in PMMA. The line here is the temperature dependence of the dielectric relaxation time for PMMA. And so these basically have the same temperature dependence. So I think it's fair to say the dye is telling us how the polymer segments are moving in this material. Now, of course, we're going to be using the dye to tell us about what's going on in this material, not just at equilibrium in the melt state, but also in the glass state and also in the presence of deformation. So I'll just briefly describe how our experiment works. It's based on photobleaching. This is actually funny, because the last time I spoke in this room 12 years ago, I talked about photobleaching experiments. So this represents a bunch of dyes that are randomly oriented, and we bring a linearly polarized beam into the sample that's quite bright. We do photochemistry on some of the dyes. The dyes that react are the ones that can absorb the light, and they're the ones that have polarization transition dipoles in this direction. So after that process, we now have an anisotropic distribution of dye molecules, and over time they will reorient. And we can follow that the decay of this anisotropy by sending another beam into the sample. This one's circularly polarized light. And then we take the fluorescence that comes out of the sample and we split it into two polarizations and we compare those intensities. And basically we can work out whether the molecules have rotated or not. And so we form this anisotropy function here, which is shown as a function of log time. There's no deformation going on here. These are just isothermal experiments. And this illustrates here, basically at TG in PMMA, it takes something like 100 seconds for this anisotropy function to decay. Whereas 15 degrees lower or 17 degrees lower in the glass, it decays much, much more slowly. So basically, this function tells us how fast the dye molecules are rotating and by implication, how the polymer segments are moving in this material. Okay, so now we get to the heart of the experiment. Everything that I've, you know, that photobleaching experiment we and other people have been doing now for more than a decade. The new part is that we do it while we deform the polymer glass. And so this happens on top of a microscope, so on top of a confocal microscope. The sample is illustrated by, shown by this green line here. We're doing a mechanical creep experiment, which is a constant external load. And so this is really how we do it. We really hang a weight over here and stretch the polymer glass. This is done in a housing which keeps the temperature very constant. So we know we're doing an isothermal experiment. Okay, so there's a lot of things going on in this experiment. One of the things we need to know is how the polymer film is at a given stress, how the strain is developing. And we do this very simply. We bleach lines onto the sample. We photograph the lines at various points. We use the increase in the distance here to define the local strain in the sample. And then the other thing we need to know is how fast the dye molecules are rotating. And those measurements happen in these little spots here, which are shown blown up here. And so as you'll see in a minute, during one mechanical experiment, we do many, many optical experiments where we measure reorientation. The idea is that we're basically trying to get an instantaneous measure of mobility and how mobility changes during one mechanical experiment. So this is the only experiment that I'm going to show you in great detail how it works, but I think it's important that you understand what's happening here. So the first thing to notice is this is what the sample looks like at the beginning, and this is what it looks like at the end. Okay, this is an inhomogeneous deformation way into the nonlinear regime. So for this particular experiment, all the mechanical information is shown here. So the sample was under constant load for the first 9,000 seconds, and then the load was removed, and we measured the recovery of the material. So this is how the local strain developed during that time. So the engineering stress is constant here, and then the engineering stress is dropped to almost zero, and we get a partial retraction of the sample. So that's just the mechanics. And then during this, 6 hours, we did 50 different experiments to measure how fast the dye molecule was rotating. And some of those experiments are shown over here. So the black dots at the top tell you about the reorientation of the dye molecule in the absence of deformation. And then the letters A, B, C, D, and E show you what's happening at different points along this curve here. So by the time we're at point E, it's clear that the dye molecules are rotating a lot faster than they were initially. In fact, it turns out more than 1,000 times faster. And so the way we analyze this data is we fit it to a stretched exponential function. And then there's sort of two parameters of interest here. One is, what's the average relaxation time for the dye molecule? And the other one is this beta parameter, which tells us about the shape of the decay, how close to an exponential relaxation we have.
Mark?
Yes?
Does it depend on how the polarization of your bleaching beam at the beginning, how you're oriented to with respect to your stress beam?
What I'm showing you, so there's two answers to that question. Yes, it depends, and we correct for that, okay? So one of the things that happens during this experiment is there's alignment, that even if you don't bleach, the dye molecules get lined up. So we independently measure that, and we take that out of the data. So the real experiment's a little bit more complicated than I indicated. We bleach and we measure mobility, but every time we check to see whether the molecules have randomized, between every one of those measurements, we go over here and we look at the same unbleached spot to see how much alignment there's been. And then we take that out of the data. And we've checked then after that correction that it doesn't matter which way you did the bleach. So I'm confident that we understand how to do that part. Okay. Yes? Yes. Why this... Actually, so Okay, so the samples are lightly cross-linked, and I didn't say that, but thank you for reminding me to say that. So these experiments are a lot harder to do on uncross-linked samples. They break a lot more often, okay? And so we have only done a few experiments on uncross-linked samples, and what I can tell you is that we can get up to about here before the samples break, and up to there, there's no difference in the data between whether they're cross-linked or not. So I don't think that the cross-linking is a crucial feature of what we're measuring. Certainly, this mechanical behavior in polycarbonate, if I had uncross-linked polycarbonate and I only did a mechanical experiment, this is exactly the behavior I would expect to see, okay? So I wish I could give you a more complete answer to that question, but we haven't. That's one of the things that Ben Bending is working on right now, is doing the experiments as a function of cross-linking density and going all the way down to no cross-links. Okay. No, I don't. So the other thing I should say is that if you take this sample, which looks like it's been permanently deformed, and at this temperature it essentially has, you go up to TG plus 10 for 3 hours, it goes back exactly to its initial shape, and in fact we can repeat the whole experiment again on that same sample, and we will get data that can be overlaid on top of this data. So I do not think we're breaking chains. So, I've pointed to this plot, but I haven't told you what's plotted here yet. So this basically is the factor by which the mobility is increased relative to the undeformed state. So right here, this is what the mobility was before we started the deformation. As soon as we applied the stress, there was about a 20-fold increase in the rate at which the molecules were reorienting, and then that grew to be something over 1,000-fold. When we enter this strain hardening regime, the mobility actually reverses and goes back the other way. So now, so this is more mobile, this is less mobile.
You didn't do anything to the sample.
No, we didn't do anything to the sample at point E. So strain hardening is a more or less, I was going to say it's a well understood feature of polymer glasses. That would be wrong. It's a well recognized feature of polymer glasses. The polymer did it to itself. We did not adjust the stress during this part. Okay? Okay. What's that? Well, okay, if you want to draw a different line through those points, you're welcome to. I think it's going to look pretty sharp. So one of the constraints of our experiment is that we're taking the data as fast as we can. And because it takes us 350 seconds to determine how fast the dye molecule is moving, and then another 100 seconds to get organized for the next measurement, and that's sort of as close as we can put those points. So that's one of the trade-offs. I mean, I guess it's like some of these complicated four-point correlation functions. It takes some period of time to determine mobility, and you just can't ask questions about what happens on shorter times than that. Okay. Yes? All right. So I wanted to point out this feature. When we remove the stress, the sample actually becomes more mobile, okay? And then it gradually goes back to the mobility of the starting material, even though in terms of strain, it's tremendously different, okay? It has this, it's been permanently deformed. So this is probably the result that would make Eyring the most upset, because I think a simple interpretation of the Eyring model is that you remove the stress, the mobility is gone, and we should have snapped back up to this point here. It clearly takes time to reorganize. I'm just saying what a simple interpretation of the model would say. I don't think there's anything in that model that would tell you what that time would be or how to implement it. Okay.
Wouldn't Eyring expect this because you have from the recovery, it's flowing, so it mobilizes.
So I think that is a perfectly reasonable interpretation of the data. That's the interpretation that I would give. But I guess I don't know what Eyring would expect or not. I would say you read Eyring's paper, and it doesn't tell you anything about this. Okay? And that's another important point. Eyring's model doesn't have strain hardening in it because it's not a polymer model, and strain hardening is a polymeric feature. Okay, we don't have to be in the strain hardening regime in order to see this behavior. So that's it's a more general feature than that. Yes, we have done experiments like that.
And do you still see a slow recovery afterwards?
Yes. Okay, so just to make sure everybody's on the same page here, I just want to clarify how the measurements are done. We start out with an equilibrium polymer melt. We cool at a well-defined rate down into the glass. We wait a well-defined time. We impose constant engineering stress for some period of time. And during this whole time, we're doing these optical measurements and measuring this anisotropy function and determining the mobility from the rate at which these decays occur. Go skip that. Okay, so so there's a series of questions we can now try to address. And I'll come back to the one that I posed, the first one that I posed, and that is, does deformation induce mobility that in turn allows flow? And I think we can test this question quite directly with our data. So what you have here is a log-log plot. This axis has the optical information about mobility, how fast the dye molecules are reorienting. This is a purely mechanical observable on this axis. This is the strain rate of the material. And you see that over three orders of magnitude or so, there's essentially a one-to-one relationship between the mobility of the dye molecule and the flow response of the material. So I would interpret this as saying that the mobility, something in the deformation creates the mobility. The mobility allows the material to flow. That's not the only possible interpretation, but that's the one I would use. The other thing that's plotted here are some simulation results, which I'll discuss later, from Riggleman and DiPablo. That's this dashed line here, and a model prediction from Ken Schweitzer's group, which is this other dashed line. So I would say the data may not prove that this is true, but it's certainly consistent with this hypothesis. And here, okay, I'm swapping this axis around the other way and just showing you that we can put a much wider set of experiments on this same master curve. Here's a whole set of experiments all at one temperature, but with many different waiting times before we did the deformation. And again, we essentially get a perfect correlation between the mobility of the dye molecule and the flow response of the material in a single step creep measurement. Now, if you do a more complicated mechanical experiment, you can break this correlation. But I think we don't have to talk about that. All right. So another question I introduced at the beginning is this idea that maybe deformation of a glass is really the same thing as increasing the temperature of the glass. So I think we can test that in these experiments. And we do that by looking at our other observable, which is the shape of the correlation function that we observe in these experiments. And so this is a plot of mobility on this axis versus the KWW beta parameter. And what you see here is that as we increase mobility in the material during deformation, we get correlation functions which are becoming more and more exponential. So a change in beta from 0.35 to 0.7 is a huge change. This is basically an exponential decay by this point. So this is what happens when we do deformation and we increase mobility by a factor of 1,000. Okay, so the red arrow is sort of the control experiment. What if I take my starting material and I increase temperature until I've increased mobility by the same factor of 1,000? Well, that doesn't change the beta parameter at all. Okay, so I would say that if you really want to be a stickler about this question, the answer is no. Something different happens during deformation than happens during just raising the temperature in the absence of deformation. And I think this trend of a narrowing of the relaxation time distribution is quite general. It's been seen in colloidal glasses. It's been seen in some simulations of Leonard Jones systems. And so I think this is part of a broader trend here. Okay, so since we already know the IRE model can't describe the results, let's say what parts of the data can the IRE model describe? The equation that Eyring presents says that mobility is an instantaneous function of true stress. So we plot our data in that way, and dashed curve here is one possible Eyring curve. So there's one parameter here, which is basically the activation volume, and we pick that activation volume in order to go through this part of the data right up here. So I would interpret this curve to indicate that the Eyring model works okay in this pre-flow regime. This line represents flow onset in our experiments, which is, I haven't told you how flow is defined in a creep experiment, but basically, if you look at the strain as a function of time, initially, if the stress isn't too high, initially the strain will come up and then start to plateau, and then it'll kick up again. So there's an inflection point in here that defines flow onset. And that inflection point defines the regime, or divides the data into a regime where the Eyring equation works and where it doesn't. And then, of course, we've already mentioned strain hardening is a uniquely polymeric effect. This is something that isn't really fair to ask the Eyring model to do. And then I mentioned this feature also. So this is at the end of the experiment. The stress basically goes to zero, but we have a whole bunch of different mobilities that we observe in that regime. Okay, so here's a question I think is interesting. And this is, so I've been using the language of mobility to describe these results. Let's ask if that's really fair, whether there's another language that might be equally useful. And so an alternate view would be, okay, you grabbed a hold of the sample, you changed its shape. Of course, molecules move, but why should you interpret that? Why should you call that mobility? Maybe there are all sorts of new types of processes that occur. I don't know whether this would be STZs or not. So the alternate view is that whatever happens when I do deformation, those processes don't have to be anything like what occurs in an equilibrium melt at higher temperatures. So I have to say, I don't have enough information in my experiment to answer this question. And so the best answer that I can give comes from looking at molecular dynamics simulations that Rob Riggleman and Juan de Pablo did. And I'll show you that these simulations really capture a lot of the features of what we see in our experiment. So I'm inclined to trust what I'm learning from the simulations on this point. So let me just quickly describe the simulations. It's a coarse grain model, which basically has just a series of beads along the chain backbone. There are 80 chains, 500 beads per chain, both tensile and compressive deformations were done in these simulations. We have a hard time doing compression in our experiment. Everything I showed you was tension, so this is another nice feature that we can compare compression and tension in the simulations. The simulations don't have any probes in them. They look directly at the mobility of the polymer chains. And I thought something that Rob did in these simulations that was really nice, he used 7 different definitions of segmental mobility, and he compared them so that we can ask, you know, how does the reorientation of a bond connecting two vectors, how much does that speed up? And how much if you draw vectors between beads and beads that are 4 away along the chain, so that's a vector that reorganizes much more slowly, does that larger scale motion also slow down by the same factor? And the answer is yes, they slow down by the same factor in the simulation. Yes, thank you. Okay, So I just need to show you a little bit about the comparison between the experiment and the simulation so that you have some context with which to look at these results. So here we did a more complicated creep experiment, a multi-step creep experiment where the stress is high, then lower, then high, then basically goes to zero. And we have the same kind of stress profile in the simulation, although not quantitatively the same. This is how the local strain developed in the experiments. This is how the local strain developed in the simulations. This is how the mobility changed during that cycle in the experiments. And you see the same trends are present in the simulations. So the one point at which we have trouble making a direct comparison is with the KWW beta parameter. This is how that beta parameter changes in the experiments. In the simulations, the beta parameter starts out at about 0.75. It's pretty high. And the changes, it's very difficult to reliably determine the changes. And so we used a different measure of homogeneity, a participation ratio. And that measure of heterogeneity and homogeneity tracks pretty much what we observed in the experiments. Okay, so from this, I make a lot of conclusions. Maybe you come to a different set of conclusions. One is, I have one more reason to say that the die is a good reporter. There's no die over here. There is a die here. We're seeing pretty much the same thing. Surprisingly, I am concluding that the simulations are big enough and slow enough to capture the major trends here. I wouldn't have guessed that before we did this. Rob's comparisons show that all seven local observables show the same mobility enhancement, and that the mobility enhancement is isotropic. Okay, so I think this is, you know, in a polymer melt, we have motions on occurring on many different length scales. And as we change the temperature by 5 or 10 degrees to a first approximation, all of those relaxation processes change their time scales by the same factor. Okay, so to me, that's what mobility, that's sort of part of what mobility means. And these materials under deformation are also showing that property. So I think enhanced mobility is a fair description of what we're seeing in the simulations and sort of by inference what we're seeing in the experiment. Okay, so I mentioned the free volume model. Again, from the experiment, I can't really say anything directly about this, but in the simulation, they were able to compare compressive and tensile deformation. And here's a plot of relaxation time versus strain rate. Actually, it should say absolute value of strain rate. So basically, the relaxation times correlate well with the strain rates, whether you're in compression or tension, even though the density of the sample is shifting in opposite directions in these two experiments. So that seems to me to say that the volume changes are a minor player in what's going on here. And so I guess you could still construct a free volume explanation of this phenomena, but that doesn't seem to me to be the most obvious route to go. Okay, so sort of the last topic I wanted to cover was okay, so this is related to why the Irie model doesn't work and what happens in recovery. And so basically what's going on is that in some of these experiments, we are certainly sort of ripping the system out of its current position on the energy landscape and dragging it up higher on the landscape, okay? And this is an effect which I think is fair to say is not in Irie's model and is probably behind most of the disagreements that we're seeing here. So of course, we know that if we just have an aging polymer glass in the absence of deformation, over time the dynamics slow and the system slowly works its way down the energy landscape and sort of with a logarithmic dependence on time. We know that deformation can accelerate dynamics. And so the question is, should we equate that acceleration of dynamics with going up on the energy landscape, or under what conditions should we equate that? And how do we disentangle that? And again, we're not the first people by any means to have thought about this. There have been previous experiments that were purely mechanical experiments that tried to tease this problem apart. And there's been some beautiful simulation work to look at this at all as well. But I would say that this is really the central challenge in being able to really model the deformation of polymer glasses, is to be able to understand how you're moving around on the energy landscape during a deformation. And so I can just show you a couple of experiments that point out some features of this. So you could ask, does a transient deformation affect the position of the system on the energy landscape? And here's an experiment that argues that no, it doesn't, as long as it's a short deformation and you didn't actually make the material flow. Okay, so it's a little bit complicated, but what we're doing here is a creep experiment on actually the same polymer glass. It's been recycled in between. At the same temperature, the only difference between these two experiments is how long we aged the material before we did the mechanical experiment. Okay? And so if we don't age it very long, this is the mechanical response that we see. If we age it, half a day or something like that, of course, the response happens later, and the response is smaller. That just, the material becomes less compliant because it's been aging. So again, this behavior here is well understood from purely mechanical experiments. So here's what we can add. Now I'm going to show you what the dye molecules are doing during these experiments. And your reference point are the open circles here. They represent how mobility is lost in the system during aging without any mechanical deformation. Okay? And then you see that this little stress pulse actually does increase the mobility in the system by about a factor of 2, but shortly after the pulse is over, we go right back to the original aging trajectory. So, and something similar happens for this pulse here. And so that really seems, since the trajectory of the sample down the energy landscape hasn't been altered by these deformations, I think this deformation really doesn't mess with the position of the system on the landscape. In contrast, once we go into the flow regime, absolutely the system is seriously perturbed. And there's many ways I could show you this. I'll go back to this I-ring format here. And actually, these are the same two conditions. So we do the same experiment. Everything's identical. We just have two different aging times. So as long as we stay in the pre-flow regime, there's, in this case, about a factor of 5 difference in the mobility of the two different samples, independent of the stress level. But as soon as we go into the flow regime, these two samples become identical, and they have forgotten their previous thermal history. And so clearly, since they were at different positions on the energy landscape here, and by inference, they're at the same place here, we must have seriously rearranged things in between. Okay, since maybe I'll just say one word about this. I wanted to make a comparison to the work that Ken Schweitzer and Kang Chen have done. And I think Ken would describe his work as being a microscopic sort of extension of the I-ring model that still takes stress as the prime variable. And so this is one of Ken's predictions during a certain mechanical experiment, how the alpha relaxation time is accelerated, it gets even faster, it turns around, it looks a lot like the features that we see in the experiment. And now I'll just put the experiment and the experiment here and the model calculation here side by side. The one thing that's not present, again here we see that it takes a while for the mobility to work its way back to the starting position here, and that's a feature that isn't seen in this version of Ken's model or in many other models that I could have chosen to compare with. So I'm not really picking on Ken, even though it might seem like it. Okay, so let me just summarize by saying that these optical experiments provide access to segmental mobility during deformation. deformation can accelerate mobility by large factors. We've seen up to a factor of 1,000. Probably much larger factors are possible. This distribution, the narrowing of the distribution of segmental relaxation times, I believe our results are the first time this has been reported for a polymeric system, and I think it's quite an important feature of these systems. Maybe just say, looking forward, that I think that a main challenge is really to understand how to incorporate the changes in the position of the energy landscape into the descriptions that people are trying to use for this phenomena. And I'm interested in this question of sort of why these two communities have these different ways of describing the processes, whether they're fundamentally different, fundamentally the same, or what.
We're open for discussion. Poor Eyring model. I think, I mean, the Eyring model, at least as it was posed in the 1960s, is sort of a, seems like an easy target, right? Because it's missing a lot of stuff, right? We know it's missing a lot of stuff, right? Particularly, we know it doesn't have any equations in it that describe how the state of the material changes as you deform it. And like, there have been a lot of models since then, Franz Papen's free volume model, a bunch of other models that have tried to include those kinds of things. So I was wondering if you had any comment on that.
I mean, I probably haven't, I know I haven't been comprehensive, and I probably haven't been fair in my, I chose the models that people use to explain polymer glass deformation. And I think, you know, I could probably give you 10 different sets of authors, all of which have the Eyring equation in them. I see only one of those models in which people have really, and this is the work by Han Meyer and Leon Hovart, where people have really tried to move the next step and put some sort of a state variable in that in some way captures this moving up and down on the energy landscape. And I like what they've done, okay? But since there are so many models in this community that don't have that feature, I think it's still a fair point of comparison.
Mark?
So Jörg Rotler and I did look at Eyring and try to fit the yield dependence to a state variable, I guess, in 2005. And you certainly can't fit plain Eyring, but you can fit things like Eyring if you include a state-dependent energy barrier that grows logarithmically with time in the quiescent state, and which may change more or rapidly or not as under stress. So aging under stress can give you a more rapid change in that barrier or less rapid change. And I think there's a huge literature that shows what you talked about at the end, which is that post the initial yield process is very sensitive to age, but there's rejuvenation after that point, and you see more or less the same energy barriers regardless of history after that point. One last comment is that...
Could I just interject before I lose track of all those points? So I agree with almost everything you said, aside from maybe some nomenclature issues, but absolutely this, what has been called rejuvenation, whether it really is rejuvenation or not, is, yes, the features of sort of erasure of previous history as a result of flow is absolutely well established, yes. Sorry if I gave a different impression about that. I mean, what is new here is that we get to actually track the mobility changes during that.
And the last thing is that most of what you've talked about, I think we see in binary Leonard-Jones systems as well as in polymers. The real difference comes in the post-yield behavior. The polymers give you this extra strain hardening, and that's partly why you can go to such large strains before they break, because it suppresses the strain localization. But up until that point where the strain hardening occurs, I think you see in the simulations, at least, almost the same types of changes in mobility that you've described for the polymers.
Yeah, I mean, I showed you for the simulations that Juan and Rob did.
But that was, I meant to say, Byron Leonard Jones is the same as the polymers.
Yeah, certainly the same qualitative features are there. I have not tried to line things up quantitatively in any way. I don't know if I can, because they're different materials, but yes.
Thanks. You alluded to colloid experiments seeing the same phenomena, and I expect these are the Edinburgh Root-Besseling measurements on the speed-up of dynamics. And then I'm wondering, yours nominally is stress-controlled, while theirs was shear rate-controlled, while the phenomena then more looked in your experiment also to be shear rate-controlled or rate-controlled. Can you comment on this? What would you say was your control parameter, stress or flow?
Well, I mean, the only thing we control is engineering stress. Okay, so that's absolutely clear. And it's also clear that most people do, on the polymer glass community, do constant strain rate experiments. I can only speculate on how to connect these experiments, you know, these mobility experiments with what's happening in constant strain rate. I mean, that is one of the other things that Ben Bending is working on in my lab, is to implement a constant strain rate version of this experiment. I think that would be very interesting. So I'll just say that even though our mobilities correlate very well with strain rate, I'm quite confident that the mobility is not constant in a constant strain rate experiment. And we can talk more about that if you're interested.
How do these results depend on the size of your probe molecule? Is it possible to extract some sort of length scale?
So they depend on in a complicated way on the size of the probe molecule. We've done the experiment with bigger probe molecules, and certainly all the qualitative features are there. The problem is bigger probe molecules rotate so slowly that we don't get to do the experiment as often. Bigger probe molecules also start off sort of viewing the system as more homogeneous to start with, and so there's less of a change, okay? And so it's a little bit hard to sort of make one plot and say, oh, I can do three different probe molecules and make them all fit together here. But I would say the qualitative features that we've seen are completely reasonable and what I would have expected.
Since you made the remark to the metallic glasses, first of all, I should say there is no strain hardening in metallic glasses, right?
Okay.
Everything else prior to the strain hardening, you can see also metallic glass. Stress strain curves look the same, overshoot and so on. The shear modulus goes down, especially the mobility also. What we observe in case of the memory effect is, we mentioned that if you go above TG, you see these changes backwards to the shape memory, right? That's also seen in metallic glasses. And it's attributed to the fact that if you shear transform, or if you have a plastic event, before I name the wrong word again, there is permeability stresses. So in order to rearrange the configuration, you have some Escherby stresses, which goes directly with G also, with the shear modulus again.
Okay.
And we think that this is important for the memory effect, so you can rearrange actually backwards, get aging or illumination due to the probability stresses surrounding the plastic zone. And I don't know if we have it here in polymers, but that's an important feature for metallic glasses.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't address that, the question about that last point about the analogy in polymer glasses. Certainly the recovery of the shape of the material sounds similar.
Jim?
Yeah, I just wanted to say a couple of quick things. One is that I remember 20 years ago, I think it must have been, visiting Ali Argon and Mary Boyce at MIT, and they assured me that polymers would have flow defects or shear transformation zones in them, and that I could apply all the kinds of stuff I was doing with abandon to that. Now, I don't know what they think today.
Well, I wasn't there, so I can't comment on your conversation with them.
You were born by that time.
I was.
But the more interesting remark is that my eyebrows have gone just way up looking at your stuff, because there's what I think Michael and I are going to talk about mostly on Thursday is this idea that when you are doing work on systems, you're in the flow version, you're adding energy. That energy, part of it is being dissipated in the form of disorder in the material. And that means that you'll have more kinds of defects of some sort that allow the flow. And of course, in your polymers, you're still, I'm sure, thinking about, okay, there's a polymer length, and eventually there's going to be hardening because you've stretched it too long. But if you want to understand this initial part, it looks to me as if there may be some very general principles that we can apply.
That sounds great. So I would say, I talked to Ali Argon about 4 weeks ago. we didn't actually talk about shear transformation zones, so I don't have any comment about that. But I said, reading your papers, Ali, I get the feeling that you started out really with a solid state defect kind of picture about what's going on here, and then at some point you switched completely to an enhanced mobility picture, and he agreed with that statement. Okay, I'm just reporting what he told me.
Yeah, I don't know how much the R4T mosaic picture has to say about polymer glasses, but I thought might be interesting to say what it has to say about these things.
Excellent.
In a low stress regime, you expect an E-ring type of activation, where the mosaic structure is essentially unaffected by the shear, but you have this enhanced hopping. But then when you increase the shear further, you start affecting the mosaic structure itself and reducing the size of the elements. Thereby, the energy barriers themselves get altered and lowered, so you get a kind of increased effect. And what I find interesting is that now the length scale, the mosaic length scale, instead of being given by temperature or the property of the glass, is determined by the external stress itself. And it becomes smaller and smaller, and hence you expect indeed that heterogeneities disappear. So I thought, okay, maybe it's irrelevant, but the overall picture is similar to what you find.
Yeah, so actually there was a plot that I didn't show, but it takes our data, so this relationship between the probe mobility and the strain rate is, I can make that plot without making anything dimensionless, just put data on it from multiple temperatures, and basically in the regime that we're in, temperature is irrelevant. Okay, the only thing for in this single step creep measurement, the only thing that determines how fast the material is flowing is what the mobility of the dye molecule is. I mean, let's just say there's a perfect correlation. Probably what I said implies cause and effect. But what I mean is that if I know how fast the dye molecule is rotating, it doesn't matter whether it's TG minus 10 or TG minus 30, I know how fast the material is flowing in this single step creep experiment. So I think that's consistent with part of what you said.
Is there Jean-Philippe, is there a simple argument you can explain to us about why the mosaics become smaller as you apply strain?
Well, essentially because now the strain gives you an energy scale in a sense, and I had a slide yesterday about that, but yeah. I hadn't time to.
Well, so and you can't tell us roughly how it works, or should we just look at your slide at coffee break?
Well, maybe it's okay. A little too complicated.
Okay. Just,
right. Without a slide or a board.
All right. So let's see. I have a couple more. We have two more minutes of questions before Andrea's talk starts. Whoops.
Mark, when you say enhanced mobility, do you refer to the overall fluidity of the system? Because if you take that solid state point of view, one way you can get more mobility is by having more of those defects, right? Is that what you mean, or do you mean the individual one becomes more mobile?
The individual one.
The individual suck, then it's going to go through a transition.
Well, so that's a microscopic question. I can't tell you from my experiment.
What I'm saying is that the solid state approach may give you the answers that you want as well.
So, okay, so I'm not going to answer that question because I don't know. I mean, I've got what I see in my experiments or what we could tease out of Rob's simulations if we went looking for something in particular.
It comes back to what Michael was saying at the very beginning, that is, if you take this, the iron model would be the model that gives you the local transition on a particular site. If you then start making statements on how many of those you have and what factors are going to, you can explain a lot of things that go way beyond the original model, okay, which is what Jim was saying as well.
That's great. You know, I mean, it may have, I don't want what I said to be interpreted as saying that shear transformation zones are irrelevant. Okay, I'm just asking sort of what is the connection between these fields and
I think there is one.
Okay. And you're proposing a way to think about that. Okay? Sort of the microscopic basis of the Eyring model.
One last remark about the volume effect that you mentioned.
Okay.
You have to be a little bit careful when you if you use the when you apply the free volume theory in a non-ergodic situation, and if you take your ergodic exponential distribution and you just stretch that, which is what you do in tensional compression, the effect of that is very small. Unless the extra volume that you create gets redistributed, and you don't get a big effect. So you have to be a little careful. But I'm not saying that this is relevant here anyway.
Okay.
Mark, can you ask a question really quickly?
Mark, did you look at molecules as big as the mesh size? Because you shouldn't see relaxation if you go beyond the mesh size of the entanglement. I'm assuming it's hard to get to.
I have to think about that. I doubt it. Yes, so no.
No.
Okay, you guys tell me what the number is and I'll tell you whether we did it. Let's see. Maybe. Yes. Good idea.
All right, just push 3.
I did it.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Okay. Thank you very much, Mark.